Hi, this is Joe Patty. Thanks for listening to WRTI Online. This service is made possible through the support of WRTI's members. You can become a member, too. Since you're already online, just visit www.wrti.org and click the Become a Member link on the upper left corner of the webpage. You can also join us by phone at 1-866-809-9784. Your membership will help keep WRTI's broadcast and online services strong. And again, thank you. Now, on with the show.
We're all smiling this morning because we have a stellar group visiting us here at WRTI in Crossover. We have Time for Three Plus, Jennifer Higdon, composer of Note. A lot of notes, I might add. Welcome, everybody.
Thanks, Jill.
Really, it's just a delight to have you all together because we've done this before through the years. Certainly, we've examined your career as you started Time for Three when you were very, very, very obscure and terribly talented. And Jennifer, we certainly traced your career as well. And you have so many commissions now that I don't know how you had time to come down here and speak with us. But
I'll always come down and speak, Jill. Oh, no it's problem. Wonderful. I love it.
Well, the point of all this is that you are all performing together. In a sense, Jennifer, you were commissioned by Time for Three to write a work for them. Plus, you have other things on the plate, and we're going to talk about that later. Renan Meyer, Zach DePew, and Nick Kendall. Oh, these are the guys for Time for Three, and I don't even know where to start with you. We started, as I said, years ago when you were just beginning this kind of experiment, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah, I don't know if it was an experiment per se. It was more an accident where we just kind of ran into each other for fun. We were, you know, booked for one gig, so to speak, down in Washington, D.C. through Curtis, where we all met.
Yes.
And we were given a limo, stretch limo, and $150 cash.
A man.
Yes. That's
huge.
A credit card to go crazy with for food and wine and et cetera, et cetera. And it was the end of the school year, and we were just so excited, you know, as friends to, you know, go to play and have fun. And that's what started this group.
We actually didn't, on the way down, we didn't have our name yet. So, like, right outside the Beltway, like, pretty much 45 minutes outside of D.C. proper, we realized, hey, guys, we don't have a name. So that's actually, we came up with a name right outside D.C.,
yeah, if we put a little more thought into it, we would have come up with something better than Time for Three.
I think it's terrific. I really, really do. And it's easy to write, too. Now we've abbreviated it. And Jennifer, you have, too, in this, what is it, a concerto for three violins and orchestra?
Or? Actually, you know what? It says concerto, and it's the number four and a dash and the number three. So it's kind of a secret code. Or at least a lot of people look at the score cover and
say,
what
is
this?
It's a new time signature or something.
It's actually, I did in one of the movements, I have alternate. 4-4-3-4. And I decided to do that when I came up with the idea for the title. And I came up with the idea with the title. And I was listening to you guys play in one of the parks, actually, a couple of summers ago.
That's right, Pistorius Park.
Yeah, I think that's right.
But you know what's cool about that is that, you know, a lot of composers will do something like that, and it ends up sounding like a technical exercise sometimes in their music. But her music, it sounds like music. I didn't even realize that until you told me, because everything made musical sense. So I wasn't like, oh, 4-4-3-4. But it's really, it jams. It's great, and it's good music.
Well, when you heard them, Jen, were you inspired, or were you there by accident, or were you kind of checking them out?
You know,
what?
I think I probably had heard you. Well, I'd heard them all when they were at Curtis, and I had Zach in class, actually. And so I've known them a long time. In fact, I think they all played in the Blue Cathedral premiere. Mm-hmm.
Which is still a wonderful, wonderful work.
Oh, thank you.
Very moving, very,
but,
very beautiful.
You know, I'm wondering where the first time was I heard. I got to know you early on in your career because I don't remember if I just happened to be somewhere where you were playing or what. But coming from East Tennessee, anywhere there's bluegrass, my ears perk up.
Yes, of course. Right. You can tell by your accent, which you still have.
Uh-huh.
And I want to ask the guys. I mean, okay, we have Nick was speaking before, Renan, and of course, Zach. You kind of had a tendency to do that kind of bluegrass stuff, it permeates a lot of the things that you do. Is that something that just happens naturally because of the instruments or... Are you, do you have a kind of a leaning towards that? Who wants to answer? Raise your hand.
I think we're thinking about that. It's a good question.
Well, Zach brought a whole bunch of fiddle tunes and bluegrass tunes our way from the very beginning. And Nick brought a lot of gypsy-esque tunes and the violin repertoire our way. And I brought like one original initially, a piece called Mohawk. And so I think from all different angles, we brought our initial roots. You know, Mohawk has a lot of jazz roots, which is where I came from.
Mm-hmm.
Zach had been playing with his brothers for his entire childhood all around the Midwest. And Nick, you know, grew up doing all sorts of cool things. But one of his experiences was going to Europe and interacting with real live gypsies.
Yes, which is probably quite an amazing experience.
Oh, it was incredible because, you know, Zach and I had played some, you know, growing up, learning the violin repertoire, learned some of these gypsy pieces. But when you learn it and then you go actually experience how these, you know, I think I was, as a young, you know, student of the violin, seeing these instruments, you know, the bass had a big hole in the back of it and the guitar looked like it had been run over by a carriage. And
it probably was.
And, yeah, used as a chicken feed, you know. And... you know, these instruments that were so not refined. I was so used to seeing refined instruments.
Yes.
But the thing that struck me was the band of gypsies used these instruments as, you know, they were able to communicate so much soul through these instruments. And it didn't matter what they looked like. And it was so passionate.
Well, the gypsy music that we know, the classical gypsy music, is not really as earthy as the music that you're talking
right.
about. I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Just musicians with no real refined technique or training, at least. To tie into what Renan said, though, and also tie into what your question was, you know, I don't think we call ourselves a bluegrass group at all. But I think what we started out doing was that Zach, you know, knowing some bluegrass heads, you know, themes,
mm-hmm.
It ended up being where he would play a bluegrass head, but then Renan would back it up with a totally different kind of jazz line, not the standard, you know, oompa oompa bluegrass line. You would jazz it up. And
well, this presents a problem, certainly, for Jennifer as a composer. I mean, where were you going with this? How do you, what do you, where do you put these guys?
Well, you know, we talked a lot about that, didn't we, early on in the process. We had quite a few mm-hmm. conversations, and we knew we didn't want to go extraordinarily bluegrass because we wanted something serious enough that could be programmed along standard classical pieces. It should be able to stand up next to Beethoven.
Mm-hmm.
So I used bluegrass techniques, but kind of buried them in a classical language, and I guess an American classical language is probably a more accurate description. But I thought a lot about all the things I knew about bluegrass, what you would hear if you were listening, the offbeat, certain kinds of sound effects. But I also wanted to try to capture the essence of these guys. These guys do all of this stuff, and they do it super, super well. You don't find that anywhere else.
And they're very virtuosic. I mean, they really can play, and that's also very helpful.
Yeah, it's hugely helpful in a concerto format, for sure.
You know, that's why we kind of like to consider ourselves a classical garage band.
That's a good way to describe it, actually. But it kind of erases boundaries, too, I think. That's a nice thing, and does it in a way where it allows you to examine different aspects of your music playing, I guess, you know, because there's a little bit, I always think about the opening of your concerto as being almost rock-like as opposed to even bluegrass.
But are they Americana? I mean, is that what you're thinking about? Or would one think of that when we hear now what you have done?
I think it probably is pretty American-sounding.
Yeah, I think so, too.
Of course, everything I write, everyone says, oh, it's so American, and I'm hard-pressed to figure
whatever
out what
that
it is.
I still don't know what that means.
Me
you know,
either.
It's just like saying it's a very English string sound. And how do you say that? But it's true. It's America. It's American. It's wide. It's mm-hmm. open. There's a kind of a frankness about it. And, of course, as a composer, I would imagine there are limitations, certainly, when you're writing solo works, as you have. You've written a violin concerto as well. You don't know the instrument, do you? Weren't you a flutist at one point? Or you played the flute, Jennifer? Wasn't that?
Yeah, I'm a pretty active flutist, actually. This I'm playing for the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center.
Well, that's
Center.
Pretty good.
Yeah,
not
with
bad.
Elliot
not
Carter
bad
stuff, too, and some of my own. But it's it is interesting. I think I irritate the flute players in the world because I write so much string music. I write tons of string music, string ensemble, solo string. I mean, it's been a long time since I've written a flute piece, but I love the sound of strings. There's something about the colors, the way they blend.
You know, you once said something, because I had interviewed you some years back. I remember when you were having yet another success, because every time you write something, it seems to be the most played, on and on and on. But I had said something about chordal, you know, writing, and you said, well, it's actually, and I said, you're a flutist, and you said, well, chords are made up of lines. Yeah. That's what they are. So it's a single line, the flute, right? So we put a lot of single lines together and you get chords. But each thing you write seems to be, it's different. It's not like, oh, that's a Higdon work.
Right. It's its own world. That's the interesting thing about the Jennifer Coe concerto, because it's such a contrast to the Time for Three piece. And in fact, I think the orchestra is going to be a little startled when they tackle this, because it is so different. But you know what? I always look at the performers I'm working with and figure out what works for them. I kind of study them, study their sound, study what they play, their energy, what kind of music they select for themselves. And then I try to figure out a way to make a piece that fits them.
And what about you? I mean, do you kind of get your stride, or is there no stride?
Yeah,
is
no,
everything different?
It feels like I probably always am lucky enough to hit my stride in each piece, at least thus far, knock on wood. But it's, you know what, it'll be interesting, because on January 23rd and 25th, I don't think I've ever had an orchestra concert where I've had two new pieces being done in juxtaposition. It'll be interesting to hear what the similarities and differences
are. Has anyone,
are.
By the way, this is, you're setting a standard now, right?
Yeah, this is the first time I know of a major orchestra
thing.
Or any orchestra commissioning two works and premiering them within a week, and really substantial works, too.
In the Bernstein birthday series, which is even more of a compliment.
Yeah, so. It really is. The guy who really kind of opened the door for American music in many ways.
You said there's over 38,000 notes in our piece. How many notes are there in Jenny Coe's piece?
I think Jenny Coe's piece has something along the lines of 40,000 or 45,000 or something.
How
really
does
obscene.
One do that? You don't sit down and count.
No, that's what a computer does for you. It's a nice, if you want to find out at the end how much effort has gone into it, they actually have to count the number of notes, and it makes a great fact for the audience. They get a real kick out of it. So
lots of black on white.
Yeah,
there's no king around to say too many notes.
Too many notes, take some out.
Wow, it's just how has it been for you? I mean, working together. Did you come together with the guys and discuss what you want to do, or was it something that you kind of, you heard them play and you just were kind of inspired to, but that sounds,
well, we actually did,
don't happen,
yeah, there
like
was
that.
A lot of conversation that went on and some playing too, demonstrating, including the use of Nick's Mac computer with his garage band. He recorded a lot of the cool string sounds that they play, and they burned it on a disc for me, and I went off and studied that and selected the sounds and then made a little key for the score and said, okay, this is Zach's scratch sound, and I gave little names to them so that when Christoph Eschenbach looked at the score, he would know what he was looking at. He would know what he was going to hear, because the opening is probably one of the most unusual openings in a concerto ever written, I think. But it's funny, because if you watch the audience, I love sitting out in the audience and watching them. They all sit up immediately as soon as it starts. And every single night after that first movement, I hear people around me go, wow, in the audience.
Isn't that great?
I think that is too cool.
That is really great.
I have to say, these guys, because I left places for them to improvise in the concerto, because you normally can't do that now with performers.
Only in jazz.
That's right. And so it was fantastic to be able to leave open areas for cadenzas, and then I also had areas within the piece where they could improvise while the orchestra was playing.
It's really a lost art, and it's something that should be stressed in the conservatories. And as long as you're changing the world, maybe you ought to keep that in mind.
There are several musicians within the Philadelphia Orchestra, as only one example, who actually have experience of doing this. Like you're saying, it should be incorporated within the institution.
Absolutely.
You have a lot of, we see now when we actually do residencies at, we did one at University of Michigan, and we just did one this fall at USC, mm-hmm. where we basically come, they invite us because we bring a whole new perspective to playing, which is the combination of having discipline, but then the freedom of improvisation. We actually do classes with them. But this sort of thing should happen and is starting to be on the table of discussion, I think, at institutions, because especially in America and also in Europe, you have all these fabulous musicians, young players who grew up with pop music and who are the American experience and who improvise. And then they get it. They're such talented musicians that they come to Curtis. Those things should be cultivated.
Well, it's also you improvise in a very virtuosic way. I mean, it's not just kind of doodling around. You kind of are an Oscar Peterson type of improvisation.
Well, it's very kind.
Well, really, it's the kind of thing where you really don't get this kind of first of all, you don't think that way as
right.
a classical musician. It's on the page. And then you're afraid. And as you say, Zach, you've got to keep together and you've got to be strict when you're playing with a large ensemble. So it's not in the everyday experience of a classical musician. It doesn't work that way. Whereas in jazz, I think you kind of start that way. You learn chords, you learn riffs and things like that, but that's part of the language of jazz. It isn't in classical music today. And I guess that's where you're going. You know, this brings to mind something. I've been watching a series about the plasticity of the brain, and they say that as you get older, you remember things that you have done, especially as a musician. I mean, you remember things that you have done. You sometimes don't even have to concentrate on it. It happens. So I would imagine improvisation is kind of like that, because if you improvise and it kind of works and it settles in your brain, the brain remembers it, and you have to kind of fight that to be creative. Isn't that? It's an interesting concept.
It's composing, isn't it?
That's right.
And that was Jen's major concern, the improvisation within her piece. She really wanted it to be stylistically correct. You know, she said, look, you can't just go out there and do something Middle Eastern if it's bluegrass or if it's rock.
Only if it's East Tennessee, not Middle
America. That's Middle America, isn't it?
Yeah, pretty much. I know we did have a lot of discussions about that, because I realized, and I had thought about this at first, that you have to, when you're improvising, you have to kind of respect the material you're improvising around and on. It's got to fit.
It's got to fit. Yeah. Yeah. Whatever.
And they pulled that off and to such a degree that people are asking me, I can't figure out where the cadenza is starting. They're having trouble. It's so seamless. They're like going, okay, well, at what point did you stop writing notes? But that's a real testament to you guys and your ability, because boy, I'm going to tell you, people cannot pull that off. That's tricky. So that's impressive.
Now, Jennifer, if other people wanted to play this concerto, you have to have the same kind of talented three, right?
Oh my.
And they have to be able to improvise in just the right way. So that's yours, I guess. It's all yours, guys.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, it never occurred to me that anyone else would ever do this piece, honestly. I was thinking so much about these guys. The score even has their name in the instrumentation. It literally has the instrument listing, and then it has Zach, Nick, and Renan.
But that's a very interesting thing for you, because it becomes a very special composition that you've done.
Yeah, but you know what? I can see this piece is going to get done a lot. It just has something about it that's... when you hear it, I was surprised even when I heard it, even though I wrote it and it's been resonating in my head for many months. Still, when I heard it for the first time, I was like, holy cow, this is going to be unreal. As you can tell.
You're fostering a whole new generation of improvisers.
And you know what? I suspect these guys will do that exactly. Between the residencies and the things that they perform and when they do this piece, it will open the door, I think, for a lot of young performers in this country who listen to a lot of rock and roll, listen to rap, country, bluegrass, and they'll say, hey, I'd like to do that. So in many respects, they're educating without even realizing it.
And so are you.
Oh.
That's absolutely true.
And there's so much talent out there that we'll probably be flipping burgers in about 15 years.
or that you'll start a school.
So, I was going to say, it sounds like a challenge. You know, when you say it's written just for time for three, I mean, if I'm another bass player out there, I'm thinking, oh, I want to get my hands on this piece.
It really is. Well, that's great.
It's great to have a collaboration, though. And this has been a real collaboration. It's wonderful to be able to adjust. And we're still adjusting things.
I was going to say, do you think there'll be more?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
You practice, guys, remember.
Yeah. No, but it's true what Jen is saying. It's been a great experience for us, you know, collaborating with such a prolific composer and talented one. And especially one that's kind of like in the family, because, you know, Zach was in your class. I took one little class of yours, but you know, she's from Curtis, and knowing it's kind of like a comfort level knowing that, you know, a friend of ours who who we know and feel lucky to admire what we do is writing something for us.
Oh, it must be very thrilling.
With our kind of our love in mind and like this. So it's really special.
And you as a teacher or an educator feels that, look what I have wrought.
Cool beans. I guess. That's what I say. Cool beans. You don't get any better than this.
Yeah, it's really terrific. So actually the schedule has been, of course, we are airing the show today on the 19th, but you had already a week before. Is that right?
Correct. Yeah, we've had a, I think actually backing up from that, 2 weeks before the Concerto 4-3 premiered, and also has a performance, I think it was four performances before we've hit today, and then it will also be played again on the 23rd and 25th, along with Jennifer Coe's concerto, which has a chorus in it. We, Christoph Eschenbach and I were trying to figure out, is there another piece like this, but we could not think of one.
A violin concerto with a chorus.
Right.
And full orchestra.
Right. It's a lot of sound coming from Verizon Hall stage.
Now, how big a chorus is it?
It's about 112 people.
So you don't believe in writing for small forces, I guess.
You know, it's actually amazing. I had a long discussion with several people who run choruses, and they told me the bigger the chorus, the quieter they can sing. It's the opposite in many respects.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, and I didn't know that. And I kept looking at the score when I was writing it, saying, oh, good grief, this is going to blow the violinist off the front of the stage, even a quiet little note, but they can get pretty quiet.
That's a rather unique combination, never been done before.
That's right. Oh, we looked all the way through history. I mean, we were trying to find anything. There are small examples of single movements of works where there's one solo instrument pitted against the chorus, but not an entire concerto. So,
and this came from?
It started at Curtis, Jennifer Coe asking me when she was a student about 6 or 7 years ago if I'd write a piece for violin and chorus. Then we decided a year later to add a few instruments. We thought about harp and cello, and then from there it went to the idea of a chamber orchestra, and then the Philadelphia Orchestra heard about it and said, how about doing it for full orchestra? I couldn't believe how that piece blossomed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, again, I think this is a work that you do need enormous forces to do it. Does that inhibit a composer in performance? I mean,
you
as
know,
far as
I thought it might be a problem, but it has surprised me. It's co-commissioned with the Atlanta Symphony and the Minnesota Orchestra, and it's already scheduled for recording with Atlanta in March of 2009. So other orchestras are already asking about it. I wrote the chorus part so it wouldn't be too difficult. So if an orchestra wanted to use a community chorus, an all-volunteer group, they could do it.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, too. Usually writing choral music, I think you have to make it accessible to a certain level of singing or singer because that's where you're going to have it performed. Boys, now, at this rate, I'll be interviewing you and you will be men. They're not boys anymore.
They're the guys, as Christoph Eschenbach likes to say at the beginning of each concert. Yeah. The guys.
You see, you'd have no single personality now. You are one. You are a trio. What's on the agenda? You have a manager and you are touring. That's in the offing, or is that up there right after this?
Yeah, well, last year we did 130 concerts around the country, over 100 towns or cities. It was really incredible to see our country.
Wow.
It's something that I hadn't personally done before, and it's a pretty cool country. Lots of diversity in every way. And we had an opportunity to play for a lot of different audiences, and it seemed like our music was, you know, kind of universal, which was nice.
Which is a great feeling. I was just going to ask you, because you probably have played for audiences that only listen to certain kinds of music that you have incorporated into your music. And here it was, again, you as not maybe living in certain areas are still playing music that they're used to hearing in those areas. I mean, the country is so diverse. So that must be very reassuring.
It really is. And, you know, a lot of our compositions are influenced by the landscape and the geography to where we go and where we travel. And it was very inspiring last year. And this year, we had some downtime in the fall on purpose because we wanted to prepare this Higdon Concerto.
I wrote a lot of notes for them.
Yeah, over 38,000.
Yeah,
Jen's coined phrase every time we complained about how difficult or challenging it was. She said, It's a concerto, dude. Actually, you really should hear it from her voice, though.
It's a concerto, dude.
Yeah, so, does that link to being paid per note or anything like that?
That's a great idea.
I think it's an amazing idea, actually. But yeah, so we had to prepare this and memorize this this piece, this concerto, this triple concerto. Because, you know, Time for Three, up to this point, we've done everything from memory. We feel like it's a big part of the way we perform.
The way you perform, yes.
Yeah.
There's more freedom.
Just like an actor gets rid of their script at some point.
Sure, you become it.
Yeah. Yeah. And we feel we can really get into character and really, really emote those mm-hmm. emotions, you know. So that was a goal. And now we're about to go on tour again. We have about 80 concerts this year. And it's downsized, but they're... The venues are really high profile, and we're really excited about it. And now we're going to dive back into our original solo Time for Three compositions.
So then this is kind of a divergence from what you do, but you're going to come back home and do your thing.
Yeah, you know what? Actually, because this is a co-commission with the Wheeling Symphony and the Pittsburgh Symphony, what happens is this piece has to go through the co-commissioners before it is allowed to go out to other orchestras. However, other orchestras are already asking. So when a piece kind of launches out into the world, there's a year or two turnaround because orchestras plan so far in advance before the subsequent performances come along.
Now, the co-commissioner, explain that for our audience. When you are approached to write something.
It's usually one lead commissioner. That's the person who kind of leads the whole thing,
okay.
Right? So this was the Philadelphia Orchestra, and when other orchestras hear about it, they say, we'd like to come on board. So basically the cost is split between the organizations. But the nice thing about it is you get a chance to work the piece, any kind of problems it has. You have to adjust the music, and then you send it off to the next group that is part of the co-commissioner, and it gets played again in a different community, a different hall, different orchestra. It's a good way to kind of test the piece as it is. I have to say, though, this may be the first piece that I've written before it was even premiered. Orchestras were asking about it. I was in London and someone asked about it.
Well, of course, you really have created a name for yourself in the last, what would you say, 10 years?
And you know, and I think it's since 2002. I think it's since the Concerto for Orchestra premiered with
really
Philly,
because
that was in front of the ASOL conference, so it was about 3,000 orchestra managers. There's not better advertisement than that.
That sounds like a nightmare.
It was one of the scariest moments of my life. I had visions of either working in a fast food place or all taking off. It was all coming down to the 30 minutes and actually, now that I think about it, Zach, you were sitting in the violin section for that.
Yeah, I was playing, and Bernard, you were playing the bass section.
Yep.
And it was actually really thrilling because when you're in an orchestra and you're playing new music, a lot of times the audience gets restless. Sometimes if they don't connect with a piece.
Right.
Especially when you're hearing something and trying to digest it for the first time. But a lot of times that initial reaction is true. It's the most honest reaction.
Of course.
And this piece, this concerto for orchestra, you could hear a pin drop in the hall. And being on stage and playing a brand new work where the audience erupts and stands and hollers and screams as if it was Beethoven 9 is a lot of fun, and it's exciting for us.
Mm. Well, it must just be so thrilling. I mean, for all of you. And Jennifer, for you, do you kind of want to pinch yourself these days and
actually,
say, what happened here?
You know what? I do that every day. I get up. I'm constantly saying to myself, wow, what happened? And I'm constantly being asked by young composers, what the heck happened? How did that happen so fast?
I mean, you're always hearing this dialogue about new music and contemporary music and how hard it is to digest and to understand, and you have to explain it. And then you kind of blossom forth with these creations, which are, I don't want to use, it's not even accessible, but there's an element of them that just touches one. And then you create a new sound or a new idea. And it works, and each piece is very different.
Well, I mean, you know, it's interesting. I think one of the things I share with the guys here is we all want to communicate. And that's the first thing I'm always thinking about when I'm writing. And I think I love the word accessible. You should be able to walk into a concert hall and not have a bit of education about classical. It could be your first classical concert. I still think the piece should be understandable.
Yes, appealing.
To you. So, and this particular piece, Concerto 4-3, really kind of crosses some serious boundaries. I mean, this is the first time that I can recall having so many people come up after the third performance and tell me that this is their third time coming. They've started buying tickets, so we're getting repeat customers.
Isn't that amazing?
And, you know, for a symphony orchestra concert, that's a little unusual. So,
so once again, the performances of that are, you have still more again?
Right, January 23rd and 25th. And,
those are evening concerts.
Actually, the 25th is a 2 o'clock afternoon concert, but if you're going to get tickets, get them now because we've already had some sold out night, so I think
fantastic.
If you want to hear it, but it's worth it. Boy, watch these guys and hear them play. It's a blast.
It's wonderful, and it's a blast to have all of you here today, and there's so much more to ask and say, but we're going to play lots of music, and thank you for coming. It's really a joy to see everyone through the years and the success that you've all had, and more to come. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.